This episode contains descriptions of child sexual abuse. Please exercise caution while listening.
Hey, lovely listeners, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioural analyst, former New Scotland Yard, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and host of the podcast Crime Analyst. And with me today is...
Hi, I'm Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer of Criminal Minds.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I am a casting director. I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes and the survivors of crime.
This is Stephen Mills, author of Chosen, a memoir of stolen boyhood.
And tell us a little bit more about your background. You have a lot of other credits to your name there, don't you?
Well, for the last 40 years, I've been working as a consultant for public interest advocacy groups in the environmental movement, human rights mostly. And I've written for them, advised them, and really focused my professional life on making the world a better place, hopefully, especially when it comes to human rights and the environment.
Awesome. And importantly, being a child advocate.
That's a recent chapter in this and coming out of the book. I'm spending a lot of time. I'm an ambassador for Child USA. I'm on the board of Child US Advocacy, which fights to reform statutes of limitations at the state level across the states. And so that's very much where I'm focused right now.
And that's a really important part. You know, I sit here as a boy mom. I have a 19-month-old toddler. You know, part of me is just reacting on that level of hearing what you said about what your body and mind were screaming at you when you're lying next to this man who's an adult and everything in your body, your fiber, your cells is trying to protect you. And I'm thinking as a mom, how do we make sure that when boys have that reaction, you know, and girls, that they have a voice, they have a place to go to where they feel safe enough to explain what's happening. It's not just about resilience. It's about everything about what you experienced was saying this is wrong. But where do you go with that? And perhaps we'll get into the prevention and protection messages later on. But I'm reacting, first of all, as a mum listening to you and wanting to make the world a better place too. I'm an advocate and speak for victims, but children don't often have a voice. And what strikes me about you and Jim, your experiences, is that as boys, you just had nowhere to go. And you didn't have the language, you didn't have the words, and you felt most likely you would never be believed anyway if you did have that language because of these individuals who were just trusted implicitly because of their positions of power.
Yeah, that's incredibly important. I'm so glad you mentioned that because I could jump right in there, Laura, to day two in that, as I call it, a hostage.
Well, I don't, yeah.
But okay. Just to point the fact that because I didn't have the language, because my parents had never talked to me about, you know, my bodily parts starting when I was a toddler and older and make that second nature that no one has the right to touch me and that you have control and say so over your own body. A lot of things that parents do today, thank God, and every parent should be doing that from a young age, as far as I'm concerned, because otherwise you have no framework for understanding what's happening. And on day two of that first weekend, with Farinella, when he sexually assaulted me, I had, and this is crucial for people to understand, sexual abuse is an adult phrase of language. It's meaningless to a child. Mm-hmm. I had sexual abuse wasn't in my vocabulary. I had no framework for understanding why this guy, director of a camp, married with his own child, would be tearing off my clothes and sexually assaulting me. At that point, my front brain shut down. I went into shock. And so my lizard brain is what was responding. And the nervous system was freaking out that I was being attacked. And it was more like being attacked by a grizzly bear. And I left my body. I mean, this is how our bodies protect us. When there's no escape, the route of escape is dissociation. You have that feeling of evacuating the body. And I watched the whole scene from above the bed as it happened and didn't come back into my body until after it was done. But there was a level at which I never got back into my body. And that's really what part two of my book is about. what it feels like to live in this constant state of dissociation, of being outside my life, of being triggered to be out of my body at the slightest sense of fear or panic, which is what so many people with PTSD are dealing with. So, sorry, Jim, you were going to ask me something, but I just wanted to mention that because it's apropos of when you have no language for sexual abuse, the nervous system is responding in the moment as this death threat, really.
Yeah, that was an incredibly articulate description of what I went through and what many, many victims experience. So thank you for sharing that. Lisa, you had something?
I just wanted to mention that, you know, Stephen, when Dan brings you home after that weekend, this is what I don't understand, Jim and Laura. How does he know? How is he so sure that Stephen will not tell? I just will never understand that. That was the same thing with the person who sexually abused me. They were fearless. They were fearless. And the child is so clearly different, though. If you're looking closely, you can see that the little boy who went up with him that weekend is not the same little boy who came back. And yet there is absolutely no fear of being exposed. And I will never understand where that confidence comes from.
I believe it comes from experience. I think they probably weren't as fearless the first time they did it, or the 10th time, but eventually they get the confidence in seeing how children respond to this and knowing how society buries this and knowing how parents don't talk about it and knowing how they enjoy this elevated position with the church and the organization, they feel they can talk their way out of it. And that's where the confidence comes from. Also, it's also probably false confidence. Don't you think, Laura, that they're superimposing, they're basically presenting it as this confidence. Inside, they're fearing that you'll do something, but they're presenting it as this confidence, which pushes down the victim even more, which makes that victim think, this is an insurmountable wall I'd have to get over to be able to prove that he did something wrong.
And I think some of these perpetrators, they are just so manipulative and devious, you know, and yes, and they've been doing it for so long, but just that ability also we forget as an adult and a child. The adult, certainly going back in time, is always right. So even if something was said, the power that person holds can easily just squash and discredit what's being said. Even if a child did feel that they could talk about it, but then that secrecy and the blame, and maybe there are threats. I mean, I don't know with you, Stephen, you know, how that encounter ended, whether there was anything that he said, or sometimes it's not even being said.
He didn't have to. At that point, he had, and this is another thing it's important for people to understand, there's a relationship that precedes the abuse in these situations. So the bond is so intense before the assault happens that it's my mind was like, I just want things to go back to the way they were before. This guy was a father figure. He was supposed to be my best friend, my protector, my, you know, all of those things. It was easier for my brain to try to make believe what just happened in the assault didn't happen than it would be to give up the relationship that preceded it.
Right. You wanted that special status to be true. I mean, he put you in this incredibly elevated status and you were so enthralled by that. And then all of a sudden he turns into something disgusting and evil. And what happens?
That's the betrayal.
You have to face that none of that was true, or you can be quiet and try to pretend it didn't happen. Hope it doesn't happen again.
And I want to tell you something. I know a lot of male victims, fellow victims in my own case, victims of Farinella, who 50 years later have still not reconciled those two things. The power of that initial love, protection, father figure from him, because many of us didn't have fathers. He knew who he was picking. He screened boys every summer. So it's really tough. You have to be able to go back and look at that and really pick it apart and realize that there was nothing there to begin with, that the whole thing was a con. Yes. If you haven't deconstructed it as a con, you're not going to fully experience what, you know, him sticking the dagger in and the betrayal is. And it's almost easier to shove it in a box and not look at it. I also, I want to go back to Lisa's question just for a second, because in Farinella's case, he was so flagrant that, you know, there, we know of many occasions on which adults walked in on him sexually abusing children. Okay, there was the maintenance man at the camp I was at walked in on him. There's a, I have filed suit against, in, under the Child Victims Act in New York, against UJA and the Bronx Riverdale YMHA, his employers. But there is a suit filed by a John Doe who was abused 7 years before he came to my camp. And in that complaint, he alleges that a, an employee of the Y walked in on Farinella abusing him. I've spoken to a woman at a camp he went to later who walked in on him abusing a kid. In my book, there's a story of Farinella's wife walking in while he's abusing me in the Bahamas, where he took me. So this is a guy who is, on some level, either fearless or, you know, as Jim said, had learned from experience that no one was going to believe their own eyes. They were, they would rather pretend what they just saw wasn't happening and move on. Or on some level, he was looking to get caught. But that's sheer speculation. You know, I just think he learned that, you know, people are just going to, you know, put on the blinders and get on with it.
Learned that he could do it because he can.
Yeah.
And that's every perpetrator. And I have to say, everything you're describing is, for me, coercive control. And every coercive control perpetrator banks on the fact that you have gaslit the victim. You've created a trust. And that's the trust that will keep the secret, because every victim wants that person to go back to being the non-abuser, just being the good person, because there are all these positive attributes. There are all these good things. They just want that abuse part to stop.
Yeah. And, you know, I got to say, I just listened over the weekend. I listened to your series on the Sarah Lawrence situation. And I hesitate to call it cult because I don't believe it is any more than Farinella was a cult. These are master manipulators. But you take that, and I learned so much from that. It was really a great public service. I want to thank the three of you for that. I learned a ton about coercive control. So you just take that situation, but reduce the ages from college to 12 and 13 year old boys, and you get a sense of what the power dynamics are and the 100% control that he had over us physically, emotionally, psychologically. And that grip, at one point in that series, you talk about how long it's taken and is taking, right, for the victims of that guy to, you know, release the grip he had on them, right? And and I'm here to tell you that I know plenty of fellow victims 50 years later who are still struggling to release Farinella's grip on our psyches. It's this is very deep stuff. It is.
And Stephen, I just, in the interest of time, I would like to sort of skip ahead, because our paths crossed unknowingly in another way, because when you finally got the ability to pull together information from other victims, from other camp counselors, from people who were witnesses, you did something, didn't you?
I made up my mind. I made one attempt in my early 20s when I found out he had moved on to another camp in Illinois and was abusing boys there, and tried to stop him unsuccessfully, and got my first taste of what enabling is when I saw that all the employees and everyone in that whole orbit was enabling the behavior, many people highly suspicious or outright new. But I was still... I had no resources or self-awareness. It wasn't until my late 20s that I went into therapy and I really began looking at this and understanding what he had done to me. And after a few years in therapy, I made up my mind that I was going to try to stop him again, because I had learned that he'd moved on to yet another Jewish summer camp, this time run by the JCC of Pittsburgh. And as Jim mentioned, I went back to my childhood circle of friends at camp, and I thought, oh my God, this is, I was so mortified. I'd have to start calling friends from when I was 13 and tell them what had happened to me. I still had a lot of shame, despite having been in therapy for years. And I thought it would take forever. The first phone call led to the names of five other victims. The first call. That's how pervasive it was. I got statements from them, which was no easy thing to do, from several of them, from corroborating witnesses. And I took that evidence to the FBI. The Child Sexploitation Exploitation Task Force in Lower Manhattan, which Jim knows much more about than I do, and I handed it to the DA in Pittsburgh, which is where the JCC was headquartered.
And when Steve says I know more about that, is because I went to that same exact task force. I was able to, you know, I had a very good experience with them. They had a very frustrating experience for the first year of that investigation. They said that the offender had, in my case, had worked at 13 different Catholic schools over the course of 23 years. Always there was an allegation. He was confronted. He resigned on the spot and went down the street to another Catholic school. And they just let it happen over and over and over again. So I was able to go to the FBI, NYPD, Joint Sexual Exploitation of Children Task Force, and they started an investigation. It went on for more than a year. I ended up wearing a wire and meeting the offender and having to sit there and talk to him, and it was disgusting and horrific for me, but I had to do it to try to get some current victims because my case was beyond the statute of limitations at the time. It's just a ridiculously short statute of limitations. Anyway, I was able to do that, and the offender was convicted and then given basically a slap on the wrist. He spent less than a year and a half in jail and then got out. But I was then in a position to supervise him, make sure that he wasn't getting access to kids again. And that's how I became an FBI agent. That's a whole nother story. But Stephen, unfortunately, had a very, very different experience. And I would like to spend the last 10 minutes of this podcast today for you to talk about that experience and what actually happened.
Yeah. So As I said, I presented the evidence. The FBI, at least in New York, was, you know, took it instantly very seriously. But also told me, well, one thing they told me was, well, he was violating the Mann Act. He was taking us across, you know, state borders from New York to Connecticut to, you know, sexually assault us. But the statute of limitations had run out in the cases of myself and my friends at this camp in Connecticut. And so the FBI would have to find current cases in Pennsylvania. Mind you, I had leads at the camp in Pennsylvania because people had given me leads and potential informants at that camp. And one victim, because one of the patterns was that boys would follow Farinella from camp to camp. So some of my fellow victims followed him when he went from Connecticut to Illinois. Other victims followed him from Illinois to Pennsylvania and West Virginia, where the actual camp was across the border. And likewise, when I contacted the DA in Pittsburgh, he said, send it to me overnight, sent him all the material. He got back to me very quickly. We had a series of conversations, and in the first one, he said, it was either the first or the second, that the head of the sex assault squad in the Pittsburgh Police Department wanted to immediately launch an investigation, start talking to kids at the Pittsburgh JCC, and turn up current victims. The behavior of sexual predators is so unvarying that I'm sure he, like so many other law enforcement people working this type of case at the time, knew that they'd be able to find other victims. But as it turned out, the DA seemed to overrule him. The DA said to me, if I've got a guy abusing kids in my county, I can't wait for an investigation to unfold. You know, we gotta move more quickly. And so they had a sit down with the JCC, my version of this, I wasn't there, of course. This is the DA's version, because he called me after the meeting and said, we met with them. They had their attorney. The FBI was there. And, we're not going to have to do anything. They're going to cooperate. And I said, you mean they're going to just like let him go quietly? And I was thunderstruck.
This is so infuriating.
And they said, yeah,
we're not going to have to do anything.
Yeah.
God damn it. It's your job to do something.
Yeah.
That is not a choice. You have to prosecute people like this. You have to get them out of the community because they will continue offending. We all know this. And they knew it back then. Damn it.
Oh, they knew. They knew. I tell you why they knew, because his out was saying, you know what? It's up to the FBI now to investigate. They'll be in touch with you. Here's the agent's name, William Lentz. He'll be calling you. And Bill Lentz did call me. And in the meantime, Farinella called me. There's a chapter in the book.
That's an incredible.
Which is pretty much a verbatim transcript of a 40-minute phone call I had with him, in which he admitted to having sexually abused me and other boys going back decades. I told Lentz I had this tape. I told him Farinella had, in our conversation, sworn that he's not hurting kids anymore. And Lentz literally started laughing. He said, are you kidding me? I know this kind of guy. He can't keep away from the candies.
Yet, what did he do about it?
And he did nothing.
What did he ultimately do? Nothing.
No, he kept promising me he'd come to New York, interview me, interview other victims and witnesses, and, you know, yada, yada, yada. I said, I have names of informants. I got so upset and infuriated and confused that nothing was happening that I started calling the leads. I called the guy who was an administrator at the camp to ask him about Farinella's behavior. And he confirmed, you know, the patterns of behavior were the same as what we'd been seeing for 26 years.
You got let down by the system. This is not justice. This is not what should happen to victims. This is after you did such a heroic thing and made all that effort to have them absolutely do nothing but let him go. Let him go. Notify him and let him go. That is what's outrageous, and it should never happen. And that agent, I apologize on behalf of the FBI. I apologize for what they didn't do for you and what they did do to you as a result of not pursuing this guy. It had nothing to do with justice. It all had to do with what was easier or convenient. That's bullshit that they couldn't put together a case.
Yeah, it was, and it was incredibly, you know, my wife and
you handed them a case.
Yeah.
You had a confession. You basically wore a wire and handed them a confession. You had,
and I would, believe me, I know what, I did it on the phone. Jim had to do it in person. And, you know, unless you've been through this as a kid, you can't know how unbelievably hard that is. I can feel, when he talks about it, I feel the terror in my body. That terror is still there, and I feel it. And, but I, you know, I did it on the phone. I was willing to do anything. I would have put a wire on and done whatever I had to do that the FBI told me. But I want to add one other thing, because that wasn't the end of the story. You know, that whole episode, that took up 2 years of my life. And at the end of it, all I had was a giant box filled with witness lists and evidence. And I shoved it in the closet and sat on it for 35 years. But then the Child Victims Act was passed in New York, which, you know, opened a look back window, meaning that victims, no matter how long ago the abuse occurred, could file suit against either the abuser, who in this case was dead, Farinella, after that, was a free man for 6 years, then he died, or against their employers, holding the employers accountable. So as I mentioned before, I filed a claim under the Child Victims Act against UJA in New York and the Bronx YMHA. And I mention this because of the behavior, and I've written an op-ed about this in the Jewish media. The way that the institutions have responded 50 years after the assault on me is really instructive, and not just for that community, I think for all communities, and the way that we push this away. Of course, we're most familiar with it in the Catholic Church.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. And Stephen, we're going to have you come back again to sort of finish the next chapter of this. And we're happy to, because this is an incredibly instructive story. You're an amazing writer. Your storytelling is just gripping. And we can't wait to hear the next chapter about this horrific story, one that you know, my life parallels as well. But in so many ways, Stephen, you are a hero, and you're my idol. So thank you so much for doing what you do. And
right back at you, my brother.
And the strength that you have is just, it's amazing. And we all, and I'm sure all of our listeners feel the same way. We all encourage you to keep fighting for your rights, for justice in your case, but also for all these, unfortunately, for all these other potential victims out there, and for people who have suffered in similar ways that you and I have.
Yes, you're amazing, Stephen. I do want to just add that, you know, you standing up, it's not just about the abuse, it is about the response and the cover up. And as I always say, do your damn job. You know, I worked in law enforcement to go after guys like this, and to hear that somebody heard all the evidence that you had amassed and said, well, we'll notify him and let him go, just goes against the grain of...
Absolutely.
And I, you know, just want to say wholeheartedly, I really have tremendous empathy for you and respect, and thank you for writing your book. And I do want to ask you, when you come back, why you wrote the book? Why is it important from your perspective? And you said you tried to write it earlier, then you wrote it later.
It was a 40-year
process.
I'd love
to hear more about that.
I'd love to talk about that a little bit, and also about these institutions that continue, not just the church, but Jewish institutions and other communities continue to silence victims and to prioritize their own PR ahead of, you know, the safety of children. It's really outrageous.
It's outrageous, and it has to stop. Stephen, thank you so much for sharing
your
story, and we can't wait to have you back. And thank you, Laura and Lisa, for helping Stephen and me be able to tell our stories, to give us a platform to tell our stories. And until next time, this is Real Crime Profile, signing off.
If you like listening to our show and appreciate the work that Jim and Laura do and their expertise, you can do us a big favor. Please head over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to our pod, and leave us a 5-star rating and write your thoughts about why you enjoy our show. It really, really is important and helps other people find us. Also, did you know that you can share our episode? It is so easy. On the Apple Podcast app, click the 3 dots drop-down menu, and you'll see an option to share to your socials or to a particular person, and then they can hear for themselves why you love listening to Real Crime Profile. Thank you so much for your support.
Real Crime Profile was created by Jim Clementi, Laura Richards, and Lisa Zambetti. Produced by Laura Richards, Lisa Zambetti, Jim Clementi, and XG Productions, and distributed by Wondery. Editing by Nick Jaworski at Podcast Monster. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba.